It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the cost of living is the centerpiece of a new ad campaign to lure millennials to Wisconsin from the Chicago area. But what does the cost of living really mean, and is it enough to make people move? We'll check out a new report from WisContext. First is our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. The president's chief economic advisor resigned yesterday, part of a backlash against proposed tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. And Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced today that the federal government is suing California over its state laws on immigration. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the rift between top Republicans and the president over these tariffs? Do you think they're a good idea, good for business here in Wisconsin, or bad? And do you think the federal government is right to sue California over sanctuary state laws and other policies on immigration? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Callum Borchers is a reporter covering the intersection of politics and media for The Fix at The Washington Post. Callum, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be with you.
Let's start with those tariffs. President Trump had announced these last week, 25% on steel imports, 10% on aluminum, and a lot of reaction from Republicans here in Wisconsin, in Congress, and now Gary Cohn, chief economic advisor, out. Can you talk about how the tariff proposal figured into his departure?
Well, it certainly wasn't the only factor, but it seemed to be the last straw. I mean, keep in mind that the president has surrounded himself with people who don't always agree with him or with each other. And you sort of, at least at the outset of the administration, had at least three competing factions, right? I mean, you had some group, including Gary Cohn, of actually Democrats. That included Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. Then, of course, you also had mainstream sort of establishment Republicans personified by his original chief of staff and Reince Priebus, and of course you had the sort of populist nationalist strain of conservatism represented by Stephen Bannon. Of course, all these people, Bannon, Priebus, Cohn, are all gone now, which tells you the kind of churn that you've had in this White House. And so, you know, Cohn has butted heads, of course, with others in the White House. He was personally aggrieved by the president's remarks after the Charlottesville violence last summer. And this really seemed to kind of push him over. You know, he was very much opposed to the idea of imposing tariffs on aluminum and steel imports. He is a free trader, and he decided that he just wouldn't stick around to support the policy if he wasn't, if his voice was going to be overruled in this way.
We'll get into that churn in the White House in a moment. Can you talk about the reaction from Congress and especially Republicans in Congress to these tariffs?
Not great. I think that's sort of the general consensus, and partly because, you know, what the president is doing here, while consistent with the way he ran, it really sort of bucks Republican orthodoxy, right? I mean, the Republican Party has traditionally been the party of free trade and you know, let the market dictate prices here. And I think what's particularly got Republicans' heads in a tizzy about this one is that the steel and aluminum tariffs in particular seem like they could most directly impact some of the United States' strongest allies. They are not the type of targeted action that would hit China very hard, for example. Now, we heard from the White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders just within the last hour that there might be some kind of carve-out specifically for Canada and Mexico, but we'll have to see whether that actually comes to fruition.
I want to bring on a caller on tariffs. Ron is with us in White Lake. Ron, hi.
Hello, hello, and thank you for putting me on. You know, I want to point out that these Republicans, especially Paul Ryan and Scott Walker, must have very short memories, because if it wasn't for their hero, Ronald Reagan, putting tariffs on Japanese motorcycles, the word Harley-Davidson wouldn't even be in our vocabulary anymore, because they would have been out of business in the 80s. So I find it very hypocritical that now they're turning a different tone on these tariffs.
Ron, thanks a lot for calling in. And Callum, one of the concerns that's being brought up by Republicans is a worry that there will be retaliatory tariffs, including possibly on something like Harley-Davidson motorcycles. We've heard Wisconsin cheese bandied about, bourbon from Kentucky, other places with high-profile national Republicans.
That's right. And I think that the caller's comparison is one worth considering, although I would also add that it's worth keeping in mind the difference between sort of a finished product like a motorcycle and a raw material like steel and aluminum. And I think that the concern that some of these Republicans have now is that, you know, we're not talking about a completed good like a motorcycle or perhaps a car coming in, and that if you raise the tariff on an imported raw material like steel and aluminum, that will have a big trickle-down effect, that it will become more expensive to produce some of the finished products that include those materials, everything from, you know, beer cans, right, and soup cans. We heard that example from Wilbur Ross last week. And so I think that's really what the worry is. You know, it might protect the steel mills directly in the United States, but what would the cost be on the manufacturing sector more broadly and on consumers who might ultimately bear the cost?
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Callum Borchers from the Washington Post, looking at the top stories out of Washington. Let's get back to that churn in the White House idea, Callum. Cohn out now. There have been a lot of departures. As some people rank it, there have been more in the Trump White House in a little over a year than there have been in the last bunch of White Houses in their whole first 2 years. What are you looking at there?
Well, I think it's impossible to deny the fact that this is an unusual streak here of turnover. I mean, you had Sarah Sanders in the briefing again within the last hour saying, look, it's not that unusual to have people come and go in White Houses. And that's true, but not in such a short period of time. And I think it's also worth remembering the circumstances matter here too, right? So I understand the president's position. He talked about this yesterday, that you know, he likes to have people with competing viewpoints in his White House. He thinks that that is a healthy work environment. But we're not always talking about tension here. You might say that that was the contributing factor with Gary Cohn, but it certainly wasn't the contributing factor with someone like Rob Porter, the White House staff secretary, who had to step down last month because he was facing domestic abuse accusations. And of course, the White House really made a mess out of that in the way that it handled public relations. And of course, losing Hope Hicks as the communications director is a blow that's really hard to spin into a positive. I mean, she was one of the president's longest serving aides, with him since the very beginning of his political career, and described by some folks who cover the White House more closely than I do as something of an extra surrogate daughter, you know, someone that he really confided in. So those are not welcome developments, and they're not just the product of a White House where ideas are allowed to compete and emerge for supremacy.
I want to turn now to some news from earlier today. Attorney General Jeff Sessions talked in Sacramento and announced that the federal government is going to sue the state of California for state measures regarding the enforcement of immigration laws. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
California absolutely appears to me is using every power it has, powers it doesn't have, to frustrate federal law enforcement. So you can be sure I'm going to use every power I have to stop that.
So what's the U.S. Justice Department trying to do with this lawsuit, Callum?
Well, they're basically pointing to the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution and saying, listen, you have some limited ability to, you know, set your own policies, obviously at the state level and in localities, but you have to cooperate with the federal government. And I think that the pushback that you hear from California and from cities in California is, you know, what you're asking us to do in a lot of ways is to expend our own resources to assist you, whether it's our officers assisting in raids, or perhaps it's holding people we arrest, you know, in a holding cell simply because they may be in the country illegally, and we're just not willing to do that. I think what was really striking from Jeff Sessions' remarks today, he really, I think, got about as fired up as he does, and he's a pretty even-keeled kind of guy, but he got about as fired up as he does about the mayor of Oakland last week tipping off the immigrant community in her city to a coming ICE raid. And, of course, according to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, they were able to arrest about 150 undocumented immigrants, but they felt as though the number should have been much larger but for the interference of the mayor. And I think that, you know, as we look at that, I think it's important to kind of distinguish between two kinds of episodes, right? You have cases where you have you know, on the one hand, a mayor who is notifying people in her city of what the federal government is planning to do versus the objection of having local resources spent on what they believe should be federal government work.
And briefly, any reaction from leaders in California on this lawsuit?
Well, they basically said, bring it on. You know, and they've pointed to some previous legal victories that they've been able to score against the Trump administration. And so, you know, whether that is just bluster, we'll have to see. But at least the posture that they're taking publicly right now is that, you know, they believe that any type of defiant act they have taken against the administration, as far as being a sanctuary state and having sanctuary cities, is completely constitutional. They claim that they're on firm legal ground.
Talking to Callum Borchers, reporter for The Fix at The Washington Post, checking in on the top national political news of the week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we're going to get into former Trump campaign advisor Sam Nunberg and his strange series of television interviews this week. Were you following these? What do you think about it? Should he have been on the air? And there's debate over members of Congress sleeping in their offices. Do you think it's inspiring, a gung-ho attitude, or unethical and, as some are saying, kind of gross? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Callum Borchers is with us from The Washington Post, looking at the week's top news in national politics. Callum, I want to turn to this story of Sam Nunberg, a former Trump campaign staffer. He was in the news initially for saying he was going to defy a subpoena from special counsel Robert Mueller. Then he did this series of TV interviews. Here's a little bit of his many interviews. Here he is talking to MSNBC's Ari Melber.
They're not going to send me to jail. You know what, Mr. Mueller, if he wants to send me to jail, he can send me to jail. And then I'll laugh about it. And I'll make a bigger spectacle than I am on your TV show right now.
Well, sir, I don't know.
So a lot of spectacle. Talk about who Sam Nunberg is and what happened over the last couple of days, Callum. It was weird.
It was weird and perhaps a little bit sad. I think that was sort of what made people uncomfortable watching some of those interviews. But as to who he is, Sam Nunberg may not be a household name because he sort of left a Trump world in an official capacity fairly early in the campaign. He was hired and fired by the Trump campaign several times in 2015 in the early days of the Trump campaign and later ended up locked in a lawsuit when the president accused him of breaching his confidentiality agreement because he had made critical remarks in interviews. So there's some tension there, which sort of made his statements that he wasn't going to comply with the special counsel confusing, right? It was sort of like, well, why, you know, if you've been a Trump critic, you know, why are you going to make life hard on Robert Mueller? But he said he was looking to protect Roger Stone, who is a longtime political operative. He now spends some time working for the conspiracy theory website InfoWars, but he describes Roger Stone as being something like a surrogate father and that he felt like Mueller was perhaps building a perjury case against Stone and he wasn't going to have anything to do with it. But the interviews on live TV at the beginning of the week were sort of bizarre to watch, just in the way that he spoke so flippantly about the prospect of going to jail for contempt of court. And then you had sort of late in the evening on CNN where an anchor who's sitting right across from him says, "I can smell alcohol on your breath." And it sort of just added this bit of evidence to what had been sort of low simmering speculation during the day that perhaps he wasn't in full control of his faculties during these interviews. And so then the next day you had a Fox Business reporter who says he's a friend of Sam Nunberg's kind of confirm that idea and say, listen, he's going to check himself into rehab and kind of get the help that he needs.
There were a couple sides as people looked at whether he should have been on all these interviews. The political side saying, yeah, he's a target of the or he's involved in the investigation. There's a subpoena looking for evidence that he may have. And then in these interviews, he's giving hints that, yeah, maybe Mueller has something on the president, on other people. So there's news value. But then people are a little uncomfortable thinking, if this guy is not in his right mind, if he's drunk, if he's not able to consent properly to do these interviews, should we keep putting him on the air?
Yeah, it was a really an ethical dilemma. There's nothing clearly in the journalist's handbook for how you handle a situation like this, and I was struck by the very dramatically different answers that you would get. You know, I could call up a journalism ethics expert at Columbia and say, "What do you think?" And he would say, "Well, you know, it's not a reporter's job to protect a grown-up from himself, and he's a public figure, and even if he was drunk on the air, that's a decision he made. And by the way, it's inherently newsworthy that the President of the United States would have chosen to surround himself with someone like that as an advisor in the first place." So take that one point on one hand, and then I can call up, you know, the dean of the graduate school at Berkeley, and he can tell me something totally different and say, you know, I don't think it was ethical. I think that, you know, there is a responsibility for journalists to consider whether this is a person who is, you know, fully able to make decisions for himself. And I had people take sort of a middle ground and say maybe, you know, the right thing to do from a TV perspective would have been to pre-tape, you know, an interview with him and not go live on television. And then, you know, if things seem to go off the rails, you could perhaps not show the spectacle, you know, not sort of give the audience the idea that you're really just trying to put a circus on TV, but that if he did say something of news value, that you could share just that little bit of it. It was a really interesting episode this week that very much divided reporters because, like I said, there's really just no playbook for this.
Talking to Callum Borchers from The Washington Post, looking at some of the top stories this week in national politics. Also this week, the Office of Special Counsel, which is not the Robert Mueller thing. It's a different thing. It's not the Russia investigation. Anyhow, the Office of Special Counsel said that White House advisor Kellyanne Conway had run afoul of some ethics laws. What are they talking about?
Well, they're talking about the Hatch Act, which we've heard with increasing frequency because Kellyanne Conway is not the only administration official this year who has been questioned about whether she is in violation. What the Hatch Act basically states is that, except for the president, he gets an exception, but that other government officials should not be using their official government offices, resources, and perches to advocate for or against people in political races. And that's what Kellyanne Conway did on a couple of occasions when she was on CNN or Fox News, essentially urging voters that Doug Jones, the Democratic Senate candidate in Alabama, would not be the right choice to make, although she didn't explicitly say, don't vote for him and vote for Roy Moore. And that's been the White House's contention. They're really parsing words here on this one and saying, well, she didn't literally say the words, go vote for Roy Moore. She was simply explaining to voters why the president preferred Roy Moore over Doug Jones. It's seemingly a distinction without a difference, and certainly, as you've said, the Office of Special Counsel didn't buy it.
So the Office of the Special Counsel, again, not the Robert Mueller thing, said she had violated ethics laws. Who does anything about that? Is there some kind of consequence to this?
Seemingly not. You know, she may get a slap on the wrist. You remember we saw a similar episode play out again with Kellyanne Conway earlier in the Trump administration when she was, I believe, on Fox and Friends, and she urged viewers to go out and buy Ivanka's stuff. Remember, she was referring to the merchandise line of the president's daughter. That wasn't a Hatch Act violation. It wasn't political speech. But again, she was sort of using her public office to promote a private enterprise in that way. And the White House just basically gave her a slap on the wrist. You know, they said, well, we've had our attorney, our White House attorneys have talked to her about that. It won't happen again. And that would seem to be, at the most, what we're going to get this time around, although the White House isn't even prepared to concede that she really did violate the Hatch Act. So in any case, it looks like she's going to really get off scot-free here. And so the broader implication is that this is a White House that really just doesn't care very much if its officials run afoul of the Hatch Act.
And then speaking of the use of offices, the Congressional Black Caucus asked the House Ethics Committee to review the practice of lawmakers sleeping in their offices. This is something that a lot of lawmakers apparently do. It was a big thing. Paul Ryan, when he went into office, did this. What's the complaint here?
Well, the complaint basically is that they're essentially taking free rent. You know, they're not they're not renting apartments for themselves on or around Capitol Hill. They're just bunking in their offices as if that's a dormitory. And so that's one complaint. The other complaint from some lawmakers that it's just kind of gross and unsanitary, that, you know, that you're inviting lobbyists and other constituents to come into your office for these professional meetings in what should be an office setting, and it's basically doubling as the place where you sleep. And there is also some concern about, could there be some abuse of power there if you have aides and you're just sort of rolling out of bed in, whatever state of semi-dress. There's no specific incident that someone can point to, but these are among the concerns that these Democrats have raised and said, look, it's just not appropriate. This is not what the office is for. It's supposed to be in office, and if you are going to spend time in Washington as a lawmaker, then you need to get yourself an apartment.
And what do the Congress people who do sleep in their offices say about why they do it?
Well, they've essentially said that it's the exact opposite. So far from being a taxpayer racket, where we're taking free rent to live in this place, we are better able to serve you, the taxpaying public, because think about how efficient we can be. You mentioned Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House. He's talked about this habit in interviews in the past and said, look, I work most nights until 11:30 at night, and then he just wheels out the cot that's in his office, he lies down, and then he just rolls out of bed in the morning and he goes right back to work, and there's no lost time for the commute or anything like that. So that's sort of the sell, is like, yes, I'm taking free rent, but I'm doing it so that I'm better able to serve you.
Callum, at no point in my career at Wisconsin Public Radio have I had to sleep in my office. Is that how things work at the Washington Post?
No. And, some of these tech firms, right? Remember, we've all heard about the nap pods. And so there was, remember that joke when Jeff Bezos bought the Post, were we suddenly going to have like nap pods or sleeping spaces here at the Post? But that has not come to fruition. There is no sleepovers at the Washington Post. And I think that most journalists, even though they may put in long hours, we do go home at night to our own apartments.
We'll leave it there. Callum, thanks a lot for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
That's Callum Borchers. He covers the intersection of media and politics for The Fix at The Washington Post. He was with us for our weekly roundup of national news.